Alright, you have to bear with me this morning. Feeling a little jet lagged. But, alright. We finished off last class 2 weeks ago on chapter 10. We were looking at foolishness and wisdom. We were discussing how foolishness can destroy one's reputation and how we saw an improper distribution of authority upon foolish people. You know, those in power were sometimes not deserving of it. And we stopped in chapter 10 at verse 16 on discussing foolishness of selfish rulers. And if we turn to bless you, verse 16 of chapter 10. Did anyone mean chapter 10? This is the last little bit. I need that. Sorry. I'm about to go on the very last page. But verse 16 through 19 says, "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child, if your princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, land, when your king is the son of nobles, and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. A feast is made for laughter, and the wine makes merry, but money answers everything." And we were discussing, looking at this, the foolish ruler, we saw that, you know, we discussed how he feasts in the morning not for strength, but for drunkenness, for indulgence. This self-indulgence exhibits his immaturity as a lad, as a child, it calls him. And what becomes of the country that's governed by such a ruler? Was it a good thing?
The rafters sag and house leaks.
Yeah, the rafters sag and house leaks. Basically, through idleness, nothing gets done, right? Everything falls apart. The country can fall to ruin. It's better to have the proper kind of rulers. Rulers who feast at the right time for strength, to carry out their tasks, to carry out their responsibilities. The strength is used to serve the people, not to serve oneself. And of course, we know that that's what the true purpose of government is to serve the people. The authority is given to people. The authority is given to rulers to be exercised for the good of everyone. And of course, if you turn to 1 Kings 12, verse 7. I guess I'm kind of moving kind of fast. We'll zip through the end of 10, and then we can start in 11, since we only have this class and next class to cover 11 and 12. Verse 7 of 1 Kings chapter 12. And this is when Rehoboam took over the kingdom after Solomon's death. And he asked for advice from the rulers how to treat the people. And they spoke to him, saying, "If you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever." Of course, this is, you know, in showing how the good advice from the elders. And this is good advice that Rehoboam did not follow. He didn't serve the people. He wanted to serve himself, and the kingdom split. And also, when you look at Matthew 20, I don't think we'll read it, but we know in Matthew 20, that's where Jesus is speaking to the apostles. And he's, you know, Jesus had authority, and he had rulership, and he came to serve the people and serve us. And so, we hope we can have, you know, the right, you know, wise rulers that you know, act accordingly and use their responsibility wisely. But when we look at verse 20 of Ecclesiastes, and we've seen previously through Ecclesiastes, such as in Ecclesiastes 6-7, beginning of this chapter, we saw the foolishness in the hearts of rulers, and in, like in 16 and 19, the ruler who has foolishness, who's selfish. We don't always get good rulers, but what is our recommendation in verse 20? It says, "Do not curse the king, even in your thought. Do not curse the rich, even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter." And the preachers, Solomon's advising us, giving us wisdom, how to deal with these types of rulers. regardless of the, you know, the faults we've seen, and we look back in here earlier, because we covered several different times where we see wickedness in the places of seat of authority. Here we see foolishness, selfishness. Yet in all these cases, he says we're to forbear. Why is that?
It might be able to change to your behavior, how you act, or react. They might see through your actions or, you know, ability to act through wisdom. You know, their might change. Might be a possibility to change them
because of the consequences to you. If right. You don't.
Yes, because of the consequences to us. Here we're talking about don't curse the king, and why is he recommending we don't curse the king? Even in your bedroom, if it's private, you think, oh no one's going to hear. What could happen?
Watergate.
It might still get back to him.
Something can happen and it gets back to him. And when it gets back to him, the king is, you know, the person in authority, right? If it's not a king, it's whatever, you know, rulership there is, you know, we have a president and, you know, police and all that. But if, you know, word gets back, are they going to look to that kindly, to criticism, to rebuke of how they're, you know, using their power? Does it usually go well?
No.
No, people don't usually like that. When we've seen in Ecclesiastes 8, 3 and 4. And this is in our case where Solomon's given us the wisdom of how to act. It says, do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. Of course, he's talking about a ruler. Where the word of a king is, there is power. And who may say to him, what are you doing? If you're cursing the king or the rich, or people who are in some limited amount of seat of power, it gets back to him and it's going to be the worst for you, not for them. And so, throughout Ecclesiastes, we're told to be obedient, to be respectful, and to forbear even when, maybe even when, you know, someone's not deserving of that obedience. We're to obey. God places people in authority. I can't read my own notes anymore. Any other questions about that?
Just an observation for practical application, Michael.
Yes.
We don't live under a monarchy, true, but those of us who are men are, in a sense, the king of our home. Those who are women are queens in their castle. And this is a warning about, or just a state observation about the bad consequences to those rule when you've got immature, selfish rulers. And we, as who are in positions of authority, need to think of the impact of our immature, selfish conduct on those under us.
That's correct. We need to, if you find yourself in a position of authority, you know, we've seen the selfish one ruins his country or whatever he's governed over. Are we going to allow ourselves to be that selfish person to fulfill our own desires and then cause ruin to, you know, for authority over our family, cause ruin to our family? The house leaks and the building would decay. Is that something we want, an outcome we want? Everyone's supposed to say no, right?
It goes the same way with the wife talking about the person ruling her home to other people, and she didn't think her husband was going to know.
Yes, that's correct. To undermine the authority of someone within the employer relationship when we're at work, or within the home in our families, can affect us. And we need to be careful and apply wisdom, not act foolishly, as his song recommends.
Look at these passages here about for wise rulers should be wise and not take advantage of the people. I think about my trips to Nigeria and that country and its government. And, you know, as we all know, Nigeria is one of the most corrupt governments in the world. And the nation, in terms of its resources, one of the richest nations in terms of Africa. And they're so corrupt that, you know, basically not hardly any of the wealth is getting back to the people. And as a result of that, the government is so ineffective, the people have to really watch out for themselves. They become their own security. You got to take your own security. You got to take care of all your own power. And they're just basically, you know, the government's become non-functional, essentially. And, you know, people have to pick up the slack. And just a vivid picture of you know, how corrupt leaders can really lead a nation.
Yeah. It's a sad state.
Mike, I think you can even take this to the aspect of even out of authority, that your actions, sometimes you may think that no one's going to know where you're at or hanging out, that you never know who's going to be watching your sin. You may be hanging out at a club that you know is wrong, but that bird sitting there, you know, it's going to get back.
Yeah, it can.
I think it's interesting. It says, do not curse the king even in your thought. It's interesting we say, you know, don't do anything or don't say anything that's wrong, or, you know, even in the husband and wife relationship, we need to also think about the fact that what if we curse our husband or our wife in our thought? Who's going to know? The Lord. He's going to know what we think and know what we, if we plot evil against others.
Well, it'd be the proper attitude, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have a foolish attitude, maybe you don't reveal it to anyone, but it doesn't change you from still having a foolish attitude. And of course, what Solomon's trying to teach is trying to guide us to wisdom, to be wise, and then thus employ the proper attitude, which is true wisdom, not just masking our foolishness by, you know, showing, you know, acting on it, but you know, being truly wise. And that is, yeah, you're correct, your attitude. to control your own thoughts, to be wise. Those are all very good comments. Thank you. before we move on to chapter 11, we'll just go through our review questions real quick. Those pertinent questions we need to keep in mind at all times while discussing the book of Ecclesiastes. Hopefully, 2 weeks off won't mean you have forgotten them. So, what does Ecclesiastes mean?
Preacher.
Yes, preacher. And what is the question of the book and the answer to that question?
What prophet is there under the sun?
Yeah, what prophet is there under the sun?
Vanity.
Yeah, and everything is vanity. There is no prophet under the sun. And the focus of the book, the aspect of human life under consideration?
Sun.
Yeah, exactly. Under the sun. Everything under the sun. We're not dealing with anything after our lives here on earth. It's inclusive only our lives here on earth. And what is the author's recommendation of how to live that we've seen so far? We've seen it multiple times. Is that correct?
Enjoy life.
Yeah, enjoy life. Enjoy life. And the outline of the book?
Intro, demonstration of life. Under the sun, futile, everything being futile under the sun, meaning the wisdom and observation and conclusion.
Yes, that's correct. Do you remember the chapters?
One to four through six, 12 is the first section. And then 7:1 through 12.
Eight or nine is the wisdom, applicable wisdom. And then the last 8 or 9 to the end of chapter 12 is the conclusion. And I think in Ecclesiastes 9:3-6, we discussed this earlier. Does that teach that the dead are unconscious? And explain?
Everything under the sun.
That's correct. It's unconscious to everything under the sun only. But not, it doesn't mean that you cease to exist, right? Once you experience death on this earth, it's not the end of you, correct? All right. Chapter 11. We're almost there. Everyone has chapter 11? I got several more copies up there if anyone needs them. All right, chapter 11, Ecclesiastes. In verses 1-6, we'll look at, I think it's, we discuss optimism over pessimism, and the two different conflicting attitudes of life. In verse 1 through 6, we read, "Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a serving to 7 and also to 8, for you do not know what evil will be on the earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth, and if a tree falls to the south or the north, in the place where that in a place where the tree falls, there it shall lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know what is the way of the wind, or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child, so you do not know the works of God who makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, and in the evening do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good." And of course we see here, you know, it's sort of pessimistic attitude. And it gives, it has the preacher's recommendation against that. But what is a pessimistic attitude? What is pessimism?
A negative attitude, always negative. Always looking at what the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah, it's a negative attitude looking at, or, yeah, believing the worst thing will always happen, right? I looked it up in Merriam-Webster's dictionary, and it gives it as an inclination to emphasize adverse aspects, conditions, and possibilities, or to expect the worst outcome in all things. And why we see here a few cases, why are people given to pessimism?
What can go wrong will go wrong.
Well, that's the attitude itself. Why do people believe that is the case?
Lack of faith.
Yeah, lack of faith.
Observation. They have no control over what's going on around them, so they just look at it and they're depressed. And they say, well, it was bad last time, so it'll be bad next time. I can't do anything. I couldn't do anything about it then. I can't do anything about it now.
Yeah, it's the, you know, the...
And it's laziness, too, because as Wally said, you look at things around you, and you just focus on those, so much you can change them. You don't do it. And that points what Sue said. That's like, that's our, you know, lack of faith, not change, doing those things. And you can't control everything. God's in control. But things you can control, sometimes we don't do it. We walk the boat and walk around and say, or whatever.
Yeah.
Emotions might have.
You would see here that the idea of
Ecclesiastes.
Sorry?
They read the book of Ecclesiastes.
Yeah, you see here, the comments are correct. The lack of control, when you look at verse 3, it talks about the clouds are full, it's going to rain. Can we control that?
Yep.
And when we talk here, this is, of course, an agricultural society, you know, it's talking about sowing and reaping. If it's about to rain, you don't plant right then because it could wash it all away. Or it talks about if a tree falls to the south or the north, and wherever it falls, that's where it lies. It's something that's outside of your control, but the outcome, talking about where that tree will fall, may affect you. If it falls, you know, to the left, it may hit your crops. Then you just lost a whole bunch of crop, or it falls across, you know, like nowadays we have fences, falls across the fence. Ah, now I gotta go out there and fix that thing. If only it fell to the right side, and it wouldn't have hit my fence.
I think sometimes it comes from your parents and your family. If you raise children that every time something happens, you give them the negative feedback, or instead of making the best of it, or tell them it's going to be okay, or, oh, don't do that, you might fall, don't do this, you might not make it, you can instill in your children a negative attitude. So sometimes that attitude comes from the parents to the children.
That's very possible. And I was looking for, the other thing I was looking for, though, is from the verses. In verse 5, what does it say in verse 5? Or 4 and 5, really, is what I'm looking at.
If you watch the Weather Channel, you'll never plan a vacation.
Yeah. What does it say in verse 5? It says, as you do not know what is the way of the wind, or as you do not know how the bones grow in the child of the womb, right? It's talking about that which we don't know. I think that's one of the things that you know, leads us up to pessimism. Yeah, there's things we don't know. Now, the attitude that stems from that is fear. fear of the unknown, fear of how this is going to affect us negatively. Yeah, sure, pessimistic people, they have that same unknown, right? But it's how you let it affect you, the doubt and the worry about that. Like Mr. Fine was saying, the vacation, if you watch the weather, you're never going to be able to plan your vacation. Example is, it hasn't happened recently, it looks like it's so dry, but do you go out and wash your car right before it rains? No, you don't, because as soon as you drive, it'll get all muddy and nasty again, so you wait. But then if it doesn't rain, and then it still doesn't rain, then you never get around to washing your car. Oh, man, I'm skipping ahead. It's this matter of this unknown and this doubt, and the fact of how is this going to affect me? How is this, it's a possible misfortune, that your effort may come to nothing. If I employ my effort on this, and then this happens, it'll be undone. So, and what do we see the outcome of that is? We never get anything done.
There's a guy, Michael, my wife and I stayed with in a meeting in Tennessee. Good man, too, from what I could tell. He's a pretty good preacher. They were him and his wife. So I noticed on his front door, he had these side windows. Jim, I said, we've got one of your windows here broken. Yeah, he said, that happened about a year or two ago. He said, their new's fixing. They're probably going to get rid of me anyway. I'll probably remove it. So then we had a snowstorm over there. So Jim's wife and the kids go out in the snow and play. Jim wants to go. Oh, they'll probably get a cold and get sick. And so then the power went off. So while the power came back on, Jim, the power back on, we'll set the timer on with the VCR. That'll probably go off again. And got a fireplace. Jim, why don't you use a fireplace? Well, it could cause a fire. Never use a fireplace. Had it blocked up. Pessimistic, but good man. That is a real example of what we're reading right here.
Yeah. We went back several years, the window was still broken. They were about ready to fire still.
And he was good, and they loved him then.
Yeah. We can let that worry affect the reactions, or here in this case, you're not gonna act on it. If you think the worst is gonna happen, it's about to rain, I'm not gonna wash my car, I better wait. And the next day, I better wait. You'll never get it done. You never get that window replaced.
And it robbed him of the enjoyment of his family.
Yeah.
Going out there and playing in the snow.
And what do we see in the scriptures here? What happens to that man? Basically, if you're worried about sowing your crops, if you're too worried something's going to happen, are you ever going to get the crop sowed? And if you never get your crop sowed, are you ever going to get anything to eat? If you don't sow, you don't reap. Nothing gets done for fear. And of course, it gives itself to idleness. Like I said, we talk about this fear of the unknown, it's also a fear of failure. But this idleness, what does it lead to?
Well, verse 10 says, time gets away from you and you never get anything done.
Yeah.
Your life is gone, your prime of your life is gone, and all of a sudden, you never got anything done. You never had any enjoyment. It's gone.
Your fear of failure leads you to failure. You're scared about sowing your crops that you might rain and wash them away, and you never get it sowed anyway. Your fear was you wouldn't have crops to reap. Then the inevitable conclusion is you won't have crops to reap anyway. in that case, Mr. Pano said that man was scared his window would be broken again. He's like, oh, I'll fix it, and then they'll just, I'll have a broken window again. But he had a broken window all the time anyway. Never had a repaired window. And so that's the outcome that can lead if we have that pessimist attitude. We optimism, of course, is the... Did you have a comment right here?
I was going to comment on verse 1. Verse 1 is kind of interesting verse, and verse 1 and what it means. It might indicate another attitude or another consequence of the pessimist. He says, cast your bread on the surface of the waters for you to find after many days. Who would want to do something like that? It almost kind of indicates to me, maybe possibly it's all the time, but foolish, people that are pessimistic can be very foolish in their actions because of their pessimistic attitude.
Well, yeah, I was going to get there, I think, after I talked about optimism, but that verse depends on how you interpret it. And I could see different ways to imply it for for several different areas. And so we'll get there in a second. So we'll get back to it. But so I was just talking about the opposing philosophy of life to pessimism, of course, is optimism. It's the, I went to find it too. It's the inclination to put most favorable construction upon events or to anticipate the best outcome of things. Of course, that just seems like a better way to view life. I wish I could apply that all the time. But I can't. But I try. But we know that this attitude doesn't guarantee success. We know misfortunes are still possible. Like in verse 2 it says, you know, we don't know what evil or what misfortune to be upon the earth. And unfortunate events still occur, and the unknown remains unknown, but we can still be positive about the unknown. And regardless of what happens or doesn't happen, many things are outside our control anyway. So, in view of that, in view of the fact that these things happen, the preacher gives what recommendation? Specifically in verse 6.
Sow your seed. Go ahead and do it.
Yeah. Sow your seed, right? He says, don't be idle. Don't be inactive. Go ahead and do it. You don't, it says, you don't know. You sow your seed in the morning, sow your seed in the evening. You don't know if both will do well or just one. We don't know what's going to happen, but you got to go ahead and do it and hope for the best and see what happens. And of course, we know, this is outside the context of Ecclesiastes, we know God is in control of everything. We have faith, as Mr. Fontenot mentioned. Subtle, yeah. Mr. Settle mentioned. But we go ahead and we work and we sow and we don't be inactive, we be active. We sow in the morning, we sow in the evening. In verses 1 and 2, here's where it's getting to it. I think these are talking about optimistic attitude. I don't know exactly. It can be meant in different ways, but in verse 1 and 2 it says, cast your bread upon the waters, you will find it after many days. Give a serving to 7 and to 8, for you don't know what evil will be on the earth. The verse 1 seems to me like it's an action. It's an action you're taking, and that there's a positive outcome from that. You cast your bread upon the water, and you're going to find it after many days. I don't know, there's some speculation that this could be the actual act of sowing, like rice, where you actually cast rice on the waters, or allow a flood basin, you throw your seed out, and then as the floods recede, it sows your seed for you. Maybe that's what it's talking about. I don't know. It could also mean charitable giving, sort of like a diversification by helping others. And if a time of misfortune befalls, you could then in turn be helped by them. Either way, it's not a pessimistic attitude. To be charitable, I guess if you had a pessimist attitude, it's saying, I'll give it away, I'm never going to get that again. I'm just on my own. And if you had that kind of attitude, those people are going to be more likely to be selfish and hold on to it. If misfortune is going to befall me, I better hold on to this because I might need it. I better not give it to anybody. I don't know, anyone else? Or it could be a form of, I saw another interpretation said this might be to cast your bread upon the water, could be in a form of trade or, you know, a business. And of course, in business, you engage in business to gain profit. But there's a risk, you might lose it. A pessimistic man sees that risk of losing it, it's not going to do anything. You know, that he's going to remain inactive, as we discussed. Well, someone's a little more optimistic. Is going to go ahead and engage in business, hoping for that profit. May hit the loss, but he's hoping for that profit. That might be the positive outcome he's looking for.
It's kind of incredible, the talents. You know, you can take it and bury it, and it's still going to be there when you dig it back up. Or you can take and use your talents and double it.
Yeah. That's correct. And I think that in that case, that man who said he buried it was scared. I might lose it or something, or the man, I lost it.
Well, if you look at verse 2 and 5 and 6, you see, you do not know, and then twice in 5, you do not know, and then 6 again, you do not know.
Yeah.
It's the fact that you can't control everything at all times.
That's right. There's a lot of things we don't know. That unknowing, causes a lot of people to be pessimistic. in regardless of that, we need to remain active. What practical applications could we, you know, apply this in our lives besides fixing broken windows, washing cars, in business?
Well, you just give an example of business. If, you know, you start a business and then, you know, you think, oh, well, it's not going to succeed, so why do it? Then, you know, that's a pessimist, obviously. Whereas an optimist just kind of takes his talents and runs with it, you know, and does his best.
Yeah.
To me, it's a quality of life. Things are going to happen whether you're optimistic or pessimistic. So you can be miserable all the time while they happen, or you can be happy all the time while they happen. And so it's your choice of your quality of life. Because stuff happens. Mm-hmm. It's just going to. But how you deal with it and your attitude about it depends on makes you whether you're happy or not.
That's correct.
I feel like your business manager has to delegate responsibility to people. You can have conflicts, they can accomplish whatever it is he wants to accomplish. Instead of trying to do all the things himself.
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah. Where someone doesn't trust anyone else to do his work, he doesn't delegate it, but then that's what manager is supposed to do, is delegate it out. Then he gets overloaded and then something doesn't get done. And like I mentioned before, in investments, or stocks, or investing in businesses as partnerships, you know, you invest to make money, to have profit, but there's always that risk of losing it. Someone's, you know, always has that pessimistic attitude, they're never going to invest for fear of the loss, and therefore they're never going to engage in business and making a profit. Of course, my company, what we do is we put in a lot of work and a lot of effort bidding for work, where someone has a project, here's a project, bid on it. We put forth together a plan, how much it's going to cost, and you do a lot of upfront work, and then say, here we go. And then we may win, we may lose. If we were always thinking we were going to lose, we're not going to put any proposals for those bids. We're never going to win any bids. We're going to go out of business. We may lose, but we have to try for those bid on those projects in order to win a few. We lose quite a few too, but we do win some.
Well, it's interesting from a society standpoint of view now is you don't have to do anything nowadays to make a living. Your government will actually take care of you. And it's a sad future coming for our kids and grandkids that we've generated a lazy society that, you know, as long as we have X number of taxpayers, we're going to support everybody. And, I mean, it's just a scary thought coming down the road, that, you know.
Everybody's pessimistic. If I do that, I might lose this or that, or I'll just sit around.
Yeah. So, also in the family, applications in the family?
Well, you can't make proper decisions. I was thinking of myself, like, finding myself. It's hard to make a proper decision. You worry about what everybody, what the things around you versus what you need to do. That's the things that happen in life. Mm-hmm. You can't, some of the things you can control, you don't do it because you're too worried about things, you know, that you can't go, and it gives you a...
You're saying you still need to make the decisions and not let
pessimist
attitude lead you to indecisive... Well, being indecisive is as good as making a bad decision. If you're not making a decision at all, and of course, to regard to your family, training your children, I know someone who is, you know, I don't know what to do with my children, I don't know how to train them, I don't feel like I'm knowledgeable enough. And what their decision was kind of let the children train themselves. I might mess them up, so I better not do anything. Were their children getting trained? They weren't getting trained. And they were headed for a pretty foul outcome. But they were too scared to do something that would, you know, I guess psychologically mess up their children or something, you know, just, you know, scared that it was going to, you know, damage them, or they wouldn't come out to outcome they wanted. They weren't headed for the outcome they wanted anyway. We can think of something else, right?
Well, I just feel like some parents, you know, once the kids get a certain age, it's like, okay, drop them off with mom, let them watch TV, and it's like, it's part of just being lazy, too, instead of raising your kids like, oh, drop them off at prom, you know, or let them watch TV, or you just leave them to their own devices instead of trying to spend time with them.
I think you also run, I've seen that you run into cases, talking about dysfunctional children, you don't know what the outcome's going to be. And in fact, as you discipline in the short term, you look at the results and you say, no, that's not what I want, and I'm not getting anywhere with this. What's the use? And yet, there is an outcome. The potential is always there for the outcome, positive outcome, you just stick with it.
Yeah.
That's what you need to do. You can, somebody else make a comment. Attitudes in the house. You can have an attitude of being uplifting, encouraging in terms of your view of life and family, or you can just be dumping on everybody all the time.
Yeah.
Pessimism. You too, probably just an outcome.
Yeah. And like I said, we don't know what's going to happen, but our recommendation is to act regardless of not knowing the outcome. Rocky?
Sorry. I was going to say another application of family is to recognize that families are not always going to be what they ought to be. There are going to be disappointments and frustrations. How do you deal with those? Do your best, and things just don't happen like you want them to happen. So you get yourself down, all worked up about it, and affect your quality of life. You know, recognize these things happen. You try to do your best, and maybe you make some mistakes, but there are going to be problems. There's going to be in the family. Just deal with it, but have the right attitude.
Yeah. And this sort of falls in with one of the ideas I had was, you know, communication with your spouse or with your children. Here's a problem. The pessimistic person's like, well, here's a problem. I could talk to them about it, communicate about it, but that might make things worse. So I better just leave it alone. And then that problem remains. Is that going to lead to a good solution with your relationship between your children or relationship with your spouse? No. You need to engage in that communication, engage in the issue. We don't know what the outcome will be, but to let a problem remain is going to, you know, ensure that, you know, the outcome we don't want will occur. So, yeah, we need to engage in communication. We, you know, I think sometimes assessing family, people who don't even want to start a family, because I had a boss once. He looked at all the other, you know, engineers, and he's like, "Yeah, these are good guys." And he told me this. And he's like, "Oh, but there's some of their kids are just crazy. So I'm just not going to have kids because someone else's kids kind of were, you know, I don't want that I don't want that outcome on me. So I'm not even going to start a family of my own." And I was like, "Okay, do whatever you want to do." And I didn't tell him that, but you know. Yeah, we don't know what the outcome is, but we still need to remain active and try for the best possible outcome we can achieve, right? And of course, one more question. I was just going to move on to the next thing. But
I just want to make sure that we don't walk out here with a conclusion because you're an engineer and you have bad children.
No, that's not what I was saying. That's just what he said. He was right. But evangelism, what application do we have for, you know, our evangelizing?
Oh, nobody's ever going to listen to this. Nobody wants to hear God's word this day and time, so why should I tell anybody? Or if I teach them, they're in a situation where they might have to get out of that marriage, so I don't want to talk to them. They won't listen to the gospel, so then you never teach anybody.
Yeah, exactly. And you're worried that no one's ever going to listen. And, you know, I guess no one's ever going to be saved, yet by not talking to anyone, is anyone ever going to be saved? No, they're not. You know, and that's just talking to other non-Christians, right? Trying to convert people. Also, you know, within our own assemblies, well, you know, there's babes in Christ and there's elders or, you know, grown, those who are mature, those who are drinking milk and those who are eating meat. You know, teaching the other brethren, you know, service in the assembly. Is anyone going to move from milk to meat unless they're taught? If you have that pessimist attitude, they'll never get it or whatever. You know, or that's, you know, I'm just not going to do a good job, so I don't want to do it. And I'll leave it to somebody else. And no one steps up. No one's teaching anybody. You know, we don't want to look at the possible bad outcome and let it judge our actions and prevent us from doing what we can. I know I know I was scared to do this class. I thought, this is, well, I knew it was going to be hard. But I was like, well, maybe I'm not going to just, you know, other people do a better job. I can't do a very good job. I'll probably mess it up. But I'm still here teaching it. And I may have messed up along the way, but I'm still trying. Thank you. And we're almost done, too. We're on 11, and we only got 12 to go. any other applications for evangelism? Any other thoughts? Yeah, we need to remain active. Don't let our fears prevent that. In verse 7 through 10 of 11, you see reasons to enjoy life. In beginning of verse 7, it says, "Truly the light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to behold the sun. But if a man lives many years and rejoices in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many, and all that is coming is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. Therefore remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity." And we've seen throughout Ecclesiastes that the one recommendation on how to live our life by Solomon was to enjoy life. To enjoy what we have. And we see that here in verse 7. It's pleasant to see the sun, to be alive under the sun. Where we're told to rejoice, if you have many years, to rejoice in all of them. You know, to rejoice in the days of our youth, the pleasant days of our youth. Enjoy the impulses of our heart and our desires. So we're given this recommendation, and we see here in 9 and 10, we need to enjoy life, and enjoy the desires we have and the impulses that can guide us. The one thing, though, is this an open invitation to anything and everything, to indulgence without limits or restraints?
No.
That's right. God says here, God will judge you for these. And so, you know, it puts a limiting factor. We know you can enjoy life without, you know, being contrary to God's law. We see this also in 2 Corinthians 5:10. It says, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body, according to what he has done, whether good or bad." Because you know whether it's good or bad, we're going to be judged. And we need, you know, but we're free to engage in that which is good. And it gives us enjoyment. He recommends that we remove sorrow and evil and pain from our lives. You know, abstain from those desires which result in pain and sorrow. And from that, can anyone think of any applications in life? You know, discussing this? Oftentimes, what do people do when they say, I should enjoy the desires of my life? What do a lot of people's desires lead them to?
Sin.
Sin? But not only that, just...
Not enjoying what they're doing, because they're too busy going about things they can't control, or not doing things they should be doing, making the proper decision.
Well, also, a lot of times people engage in those things that, and apart from just sin against God, they engage in things that, I think this is pleasurable. This is going to... I'm going to like this. And engage in things that bring them pain and sorrow. drugs. Yes?
But enjoying life is not... But some people think enjoying life is a sin. Enjoying life is a command. God wants us to enjoy life. And people think, well, if I'm having fun or I'm enjoying life, then I must be doing something wrong because I'm having a good time.
That's not the case at all in Ecclesiastes. Every time every other chapter, we see we enjoy life. But I think we're